Harper Audio presents Shit My Dad Says by Justin Halpern. Read by Sean Schimmel. Copyright 2010 by Justin Halpern. Production copyright 2010 by HarperCollins Publishers. The names and identifying characteristics of some of the individuals featured throughout this book have been changed to protect their privacy. Introduction.
All I ask is that you pick up your shit so you don't leave your bedroom looking like it was used for a gangbang. Also, sorry that your girlfriend dumped you.
When I was 28 years old, I lived in Los Angeles and was in the third year of a long-distance relationship with my girlfriend, who lived in San Diego. Most Fridays, I'd sit in traffic for 3.5 hours as my 1999 Ford Ranger crawled 126 miles down the I-5 to San Diego. Every once in a while, my car would decide to shut off its engine. Meanwhile, its radio was busted, so I only got one station, whose playlist seemed limited to songs from the burgeoning rapper Flo Rida. There's nothing like merging onto a freeway only to have your engine stop, steering wheel lock, and the DJ scream,
"And here's my man, Flo Rida, with his new hit, Right Round. Let's get this party started!"
In short, doing the long-distance thing was wearing on me. So when I received a job offer in May 2009 from Maxim.com that would allow me to work from anywhere, I jumped at the opportunity. I could move down to San Diego and live with my girlfriend. The only hitch in my plan was that my girlfriend was not as excited as I was. And by not as excited, I mean to say that when I showed up at her doorstep to deliver the good news in person, she broke up with me. Driving away from her house, I realized that not only was I now single, I had no place to live since I already told my landlord in Los Angeles that I was terminating my lease at the end of the month. Then my engine shut off. As I sat in my car vigorously trying to restart it, it dawned on me that the only people I knew in San Diego who might have room for me were my parents. My stomach started to tense up as I turned the key back and forth in the ignition. It also dawned on me that the family barbecuing on the deck of the house in front of which my car had stalled just might think I was a perv who pulled over to pleasure himself. Luckily, my car started up within a minute, and I sped off for my parents' house. The reason I had become so nervous so quickly was because asking my father for a favor is like arguing a case in front of the Supreme Court. You have to lay out the facts clearly, organize them into an argument, and cite precedents set in previous cases. Shortly after showing up unannounced at my parents' modest three-bedroom house in our San Diego suburb, Point Loma, I was pleading my case before my parents in the living room. I cited my dad versus my brother Daniel Halpern, which led to my brother Dan living at home when he was 29 and going through a transitional phase. About halfway through my argument, my dad cut me off.
"It's fine. Jesus, you didn't have to go through that whole bullshit song and dance. You know you can stay here. All I ask is that you pick up your shit so you don't leave your bedroom looking like it was used for a gangbang," he said. "Also, sorry that your girlfriend dumped you."
The last time I had lived at home was 10 years prior, during my sophomore year at San Diego State University. At the time, both my parents worked, my mother as a lawyer for a nonprofit, and my father in nuclear medicine at the University of California, San Diego, so I didn't see them very often. 10 years later, my mom was still working full-time, but my 73-year-old dad had retired and was around the house all day long. After my first night back home, I crawled out of bed at around 8:30 a.m. and set up my office, read my laptop, in the living room where my dad was watching TV, to begin writing my first column. Michael Jackson had just died, and I was working on a comic portraying Jesus overlooking the pedophile charges against Michael Jackson and letting him into heaven anyway because he was such a fan of the King of Pop. My editor later pointed out that it should have been St. Peter ushering MJ through the gates of heaven, but that's beside the point. My dad had a hard time understanding that someone sitting in his pajamas and searching through Google images for silly pictures of Jesus Christ was working, so he treated me like I wasn't.
"Why the fuck is Wolf Blitzer talking to me about Michael Jackson?" he barked. The president is in fucking Russia trying to get those sons of bitches to stop with the nukes, and he's talking to me about Michael Jackson. Fuck you, Wolf Blitzer!
Every so often throughout the rest of the day, my dad would get fired up about something, bound into the living room from the kitchen or front yard or wherever he'd been, and shout something like,
Are you putting ketchup on that hamburger I made you?
Yeah, why?
Why? What the fuck do you mean, why? That's a gourmet hamburger. This ain't some horse shit you cook. I spent time on that. Next time, I make shit for you.
It was good to be home. For as long as I've known him, my father has been a blunt individual. When I was little, I mostly felt terrified of him, so I couldn't appreciate that I was dealing with the least passive-aggressive human being on the planet. Now, as an adult, all day long I dealt with people, friends, coworkers, relatives, who never really said what they were thinking. The more time I spent with my dad in those first couple months back home, the more grateful I started to feel for the mixture of honesty and insanity that characterized his comments and personality. One day, I was on a walk with him and my dog Angus, who was sniffing around in a bush outside a neighbor's house. My dad turned to me and said,
Look at the dog's asshole.
What? Why?
You can tell by the dilation of his asshole that he's going to shit soon. See? There it goes.
It was at that moment, as my dog emptied his bowels in my neighbor's yard and my dad stood there proudly watching his prediction come true, that I realized how wise, even prophetic, he really is. I took that quote and posted it as my instant messenger away status that evening. And every day after that, I take one funny remark my dad said and use it to update my status. When one of my friends suggested I create a Twitter page to keep a record of all the crazy things that come out of his mouth, I started Shit My Dad Says. For about a week, I had only a handful of followers, a couple of friends who knew my dad and thought he was a character. Then one day, I woke up to find that 1,000 people were following me. The next day, 10,000, then 50,000, then 100, 200, 300,000. And suddenly, a picture of my dad's face and his quotes were popping up everywhere. Literary agents were calling, wanting to represent me. TV producers were inviting me onto their shows, and reporters were asking for interviews. My first thought was, this is not good. The emotion that followed can only be described as sheer panic. To illustrate how my father hates any kind of public attention, let me share his opinion of contestants who compete on Jeopardy. My dad's a well-read, educated guy. And one evening when I was watching Jeopardy, he strolled into the living room and correctly answered every question Alex Trebek posed. Dad, you should totally go on Jeopardy, I said.
Are you fucking kidding me? Look at those people. They have no fucking respect for themselves, no dignity. Going on a reality show like that, it sickens me.
I knew I had to tell my dad that I had been posting his quotes and quips online and now had publishers and TV studios interested in adaptations of the material. But before I did, I figured I'd call my oldest brother Dan with the hope that he would tell me I was blowing the situation out of proportion and that our dad would be fine with it.
Holy shit, you did what?
Dan said to me in between giant belly laughs.
Dude, Dad is going to... I don't even know what Dad's going to do. You'd better be prepared to leave his house. Like, if I were you, I'd pack up my stuff beforehand, fugitive style. Only important belongings that can be carried with one arm.
I decided to take a walk around the block and gather my thoughts before I confronted my father. A walk around the block turned into a few miles around the block, and as I was finally heading back toward the house an hour later, I spotted him sitting on our front porch looking like he was in a good mood. I figured it was now or never. Hey, Dad, I have to tell you something weird, I said, tentatively sidling up next to him on a nearby deck chair.
You have to tell me something weird, huh? What is weird that you have to tell me?
He replied. So there's this thing called Twitter, I said.
I know what Twitter is, goddammit. You talk to me like I don't know what shit is. I know what it is. You have to start up the internet to get on Twitter,
he said, making the universal sign for turning a key in the ignition when he said the words, start up the internet. I laid it all out there. The Twitter page, the hundreds of thousands of followers, the news articles, the book publishers, the TV producers, all of it. He sat quietly and listened. Then he laughed, stood up, ironing out his pants with his hands and said,
Have you seen my cell phone? Can you call it? I can't find it.
So you're cool with all this? You're cool with me writing a book, the quotes, everything? I asked.
What do I give a fuck? I don't care what people think of me. Publish whatever you want. I just got two rules. I'm not talking to anyone, and whatever money you get, keep. I got my own fucking money. I don't need yours, he said. Now, call my cell phone, goddammit.
Never assume that which you do not know.
Well, what the fuck makes you think Grandpa wants to sleep in the same room as you?
In the summer of 1987, when I was 6 years old, my cousin got married on a farm in Washington State. My family lived in San Diego, and my dad decided there was no way he was paying $1,000 for himself, my mother, my two brothers, and me to fly up the coast.
Why am I going to pay $200 so a six-year-old can see a wedding?
He said to my mother.
You think that's a moment Justin cares about? 2 years ago, he was still shitting in his pants. If everyone has to go, we're driving.
And so we did. I squished in between my two older brothers, Dan, who was 16 at the time, and Evan, 14 and gangly, in the back seat of our 82 Thunderbird. My mom rode shotgun, and my dad took the wheel as we began the 1,800-mile trip up to Washington. We made it about 4 miles before my brothers and I started tormenting one another, which mostly consisted of them hitting me and saying stuff like, "How come you're sitting like a gay? I bet it's 'cause you're a gay!" My dad dramatically swerved off to the side of the road, tires squealing in our wake, and whipped his head around to the three of us.
You listen to me. I'm not gonna deal with any of your bullshit, understand? We will all behave like human fucking beings.
But we didn't. There was no way we could have. This wasn't a situation that human fucking beings were built for. We were five people, three of us males under the age of 17, sitting a half inch from one another for 16 hours a day, as the seemingly endless highway inched by. This was not a normal sightseeing family vacation. It was like we were running from the law. We drove all day and all night, growing more and more sweaty and on edge by the hour, with my dad regularly making desperate comments to himself like,
"We just gotta fucking get there. It can't be that much farther."
More than a day and a half later, after 24 hours of driving, we made it to Olympia, Washington, where we met our extended family in the lobby of a hotel. In total, about 60 of us Halperns were staying there, including my 90-year-old grandpa, my dad's father. A quiet but tough guy, he hated when people made a big deal about him. He had run a tobacco farm in Kentucky until he was 75, and just because he was older now, he wasn't about to start accepting help where, in his opinion, it wasn't necessary. My family had reserved a block of hotel rooms, each to be shared by two people, but no one had been assigned to a specific room yet. My brothers quickly decided they would share a room with each other, and my mom and dad would obviously share one, which left me without a partner. For some reason, all my adult relatives thought it would be just so cute if I shared a room with Grandpa. Grandpa had stayed with us in San Diego before, and I remember he always kept a bottle of Wild Turkey in his room and would clandestinely take a swig from time to time. Once, when my brother Dan caught him in the act, Grandpa shouted, "You got me!" and then laughed hysterically. I also remembered that he needed help getting out of bed but got really angry when anyone tried to assist him. There was no way I wanted to share a room with Grandpa, but I kept my concerns to myself because I figured my family would hate me for being so unfriendly. So, like any six-year-old who doesn't want to do something, I faked being sick, which attracted a lot more attention to me. Upon hearing that I wasn't feeling well, my aunts hurried me down the carpeted hallway to my parents' room and burst into it like it was an episode of ER.
"Okay, everyone calm down, goddammit. Now leave so I can check out the boy," my dad shouted.
My aunts cleared out, leaving the two of us alone. He looked me in the eye and felt my forehead with his hand.
"You say you're sick, huh? Well, it looks like you've come down with a case of bullshit. You ain't sick. What's the problem here? We just drove a goddamn continent, and I'm tired. Spit it out."
"Everybody wants me to share a room with Grandpa, but I don't want to,"
I replied.
"Well, what the fuck makes you think Grandpa wants to sleep in the same room as you?"
I hadn't thought about that.
"I don't know."
"Well, let's go ask him."
We walked down the hallway to the room Grandpa had staked out. He was busy getting ready for bed.
"Look here, Dad. Justin doesn't want to share a room with you. What do you think about that?"
I cowered behind my dad's leg as he kept shoving me away toward my grandfather to make me face him. Grandpa looked me in the eye for a second.
"Well, I don't want to share a room with him neither. I want my own room," he said.
My dad turned and looked at me like he had just uncovered the missing clue in a murder case.
There you have it, he said. Apparently, you're no goddamn peach either.
On toilet training.
You are 4 years old. You have to shit in the toilet. This is not one of those negotiations where we'll go back and forth and find a middle ground. This ends with you shitting in a toilet.
On my first day of kindergarten.
You thought it was hard? If kindergarten is busting your ass, I got some bad news for you about the rest of life.
On accidents.
I don't give a shit how it happened. The window is broken. Wait, why is there syrup everywhere? Okay, you know what? Now I give a shit how it happened. Let's hear it.
On my 7th birthday party.
No, you can't have a bouncy house at your birthday party. What do you mean, why? Have you ever thought to yourself, where would I put a goddamn bouncy house in our backyard? Yeah, that's right. That's the kind of shit I think about, that you just think magically appears.
On talking to strangers.
Listen up, if someone is being nice to you and you don't know them, run away. No one is nice to you just to be nice to you, and if they are, well, they can go take their pleasant ass somewhere else.
On table manners.
Jesus Christ, can we have one dinner where you don't spill something? No, Joni, he does it on purpose, because if he doesn't, that means he's just mentally handicapped, and none of the tests showed that.
On crying.
I had no problem with you crying. My only concern was with the snot that was coming out of your nose. Where does that go? On your hands? Your shirt? That's no good. Oh, Jesus, don't start crying.
On spending the night at a friend's house for the first time.
Try not to piss yourself.
On being teased.
So he called you a homo. Big deal. There's nothing wrong with being a homosexual. No, I'm not saying you're a homosexual. Jesus Christ, now I'm starting to see why this kid was giving you shit.
On feeling comfortable in one's own skin.
It's my house. I'll wear clothes when I want to wear clothes, and I'll be naked when I want to be naked. The fact that your friends are coming over shortly is inconsequential to that. AKA, I don't give a shit.
A man's house is his house.
This is my house, goddammit! I gotta defend my house!
When I was 7 years old, my dad invited me into his bedroom to show me his Mossberg shotgun.
Here's the trigger, here's the loading mechanism, here's the sight so you can see whatever the fuck you're shooting, and here's how you hold it, he said, cradling the gun. Now, don't ever fucking touch it.
The reason that my dad kept a shotgun on top of the cabinet above his bed was because he was convinced that we were always just about to be robbed.
We have a lot of shit in this house. People want that shit. I do not want them to get our shit. Make sense?
It did, but to my dad, anyone making noise inside our house after 1 a.m. was likely a burglar. I never understood where his anxiety came from because we lived in a suburb. I once asked him about it, and he responded simply,
I came from a different time.
What time was that, Dad?
I don't fucking know. A different one. Jesus, stop asking me questions and just be thankful I give a shit.
Despite his ever-present fear of burglars, my father likes to get comfy when he goes to bed, meaning that he always sleeps naked. And when he's naked, he looks like something that pops up from behind a bush in a Jim Henson film and starts singing, super hairy, with eyebrows that defy gravity. One night, shortly after he showed me his shotgun, my dad awoke to hear a rumbling in the kitchen at about 1:45 a.m. He immediately grabbed his gun from over the bed, told my mom to stay put, and walked bare-ass naked toward the noise, gun out in front, hand on the trigger. I woke up when I heard him clomp past my door and peeped my head out of my bedroom, just in time to see him get down on all fours with his shotgun and army crawl toward the door that led to the kitchen. My dad stopped in the middle of the hallway, then aimed his shotgun at the closed door and yelled,
Come through this door, and I'll fucking kill you!
Inside the kitchen was my mom's sister, Aunt Jean, who was staying with us, and, unaware of the 1 a.m. burglar rule, had decided to fix herself a late-night snack. Upon hearing his threat, she opened the door, spotted my father naked on the floor, with a shotgun pointed at her and his exposed rear reflecting the light from the kitchen. She ran past him into her room and slammed the door. My dad assumed she was just afraid of the burglar and remained agitated. Oblivious to what was going on outside her bedroom, my mom called 911.
Sam, the police are on the way. Put your gun down and your clothes on,
she hollered from the other side of the house.
Fuck that! I ain't doing either! This is my house, goddammit! I gotta defend my house!
He yelled back. The police finally showed up, determined that there had been no foul play, and encouraged my father to put his clothes on and disarm himself. The next morning, my brothers, my parents, and I sat silently at the breakfast table. When my aunt came out of her room for the first time since she had retreated from my naked, gun-wielding father, she was not talkative either. Just in case I hadn't realized what happened, my brother Dan leaned over and whispered to me,
"She saw Dad's wiener, then he tried to kill her."
My dad turned to us and said in a serious tone,
"I guess I should fill you in on what happened last night. No one broke into the house, but remember, a man's house is his house."
He took one last bite of grape nuts and chirped,
"Okay, gotta go to work."
On chivalry.
Give your mother the front seat. I don't give a shit if she said you could have it. That's what she's supposed to do, and you're supposed to say, "No, I insist." You think I'm gonna drive around with my wife in the back seat and a 9-year-old in the front? You're a crazy son of a bitch.
On candy.
Jesus Christ, one fucking Snickers bar and you're running around like your asshole is on fire. Okay, outside you go. Don't come back until you're ready to sleep or shit.
On going away to camp.
Relax, it'll be fine. You'll build fires, set up tents, sleep outside. It'll be fun. Oh, it's basketball camp. Huh. Well, cross out that shit I said you were gonna do and just replace it with play basketball, I guess.
On summer vacation.
Watching TV all day is not an option. If this were Let's Make a Deal, that would not be behind one of the doors to choose from.
On off-limit zones in hide-and-go-seek.
What the fuck are you doing in my closet? Don't shush me, it's my fucking closet!
On sportsmanship.
You pitched a great game, you really did. I'm proud of you. Unfortunately, your team is shitty. No, you can't go getting mad at people because they're shitty. Life will get mad at them, don't worry.
On getting in trouble at school.
Why would you throw a ball in someone's face? Huh, that's a pretty good reason. Well, I can't do much about your teacher being pissed, but me and you are good.
On making a Christmas list.
You rank the 25 presents you want in order of how much you want them? Are you insane? I said tell me what you want for Christmas, not make a fucking college football poll.
On water slides.
You go on ahead. I'd rather not be shot out of a tube into a pool filled with a bunch of 9-year-olds' urine.
On packing my own lunch.
You have to pack a sandwich. It can't be just cookies and bullshit. No, I said if you packed it yourself, you could pack it how you want it, not pack it like a moron.
It's important to behave oneself.
Fucking hell! All I asked, goddammit, was that you sit still for a couple hours while I lectured on thyroid cancer!
When I turned 10, my mom decided she wanted to go to law school. My dad was supportive of her career goals, even though they meant that he'd have to assume more of the responsibility of watching me.
Me and you are going to be spending more time together, but a lot of that time I'm going to be working, and I'm going to need you to not talk and entertain yourself,
he explained to me after my mother showed us her first semester's class schedule. Like a lot of kids, I never really understood what my dad did for a living. All I knew was that it was called nuclear medicine, and that he often came home from work tired and irritable. On a couple weekday afternoons before my mom went back to school for her law degree, she'd been unable to watch me and had dropped me off at the VA, which was one of the hospitals my dad worked at. On each occasion, he'd come out of his office to greet me, hand me a Snickers bar from his pocket, then walk me into a spare, unoccupied office near his.
I got a couple hours more of work, so, you know, just sit here for a bit,
he'd say. Inevitably, I'd try to get him to nail down a specific time frame.
Is 2 hours the longest I'll be here, or could it be longer?
I'd ask.
I don't know, son. I'm not a fucking psychic. I promise you, as soon as I'm done, we'll leave and I'll buy you an ice cream.
Then he'd look around the office and find a magazine for me to read.
Here, you can take a look at the New England Journal of Medicine. Lots of interesting stuff in there.
Once my mom got into the thick of her law school classes, my dad had to pick up more and more of her slack, and I spent frequent afternoons counting down the minutes until he and I could leave the hospital and head home. Weekends were usually fine, because I could go to a friend's house. But on one particular weekend, my mom was busy preparing for a test, and my dad had to give a speech to 100 doctors, and none of my friends or family could watch me.
"I think we can just leave him at the house. He'll be fine," my dad said to my mom.
"Sam, I'm not leaving him alone here by himself. He's 10,
my mom replied.
"Fine, I'll take him, goddammit."
I hopped into my dad's Oldsmobile, and we headed up to the University of California San Diego campus. He didn't say much as he was driving, but I could see he was annoyed. As we pulled up to the lecture hall, he turned to me and said,
"I need you to be well-behaved, you understand? No bullshit."
"Can I draw stuff?"
I asked.
"What does that mean? What would you draw? I don't want one of these guys walking up to you and you're drawing two dogs fucking or something. I gotta be professional here."
"I don't know how to draw that. I just draw airplanes," I said.
He opened up his black leather briefcase, grabbed a piece of lined notepad paper and a multicolored pen, and handed them to me. We got out of the car, and I followed him through the glass doors of a big university building and through the lobby to a lecture hall that was filled with doctors, all of whom seemed to know my dad. He introduced me to a few people and then took me over to the back row of chairs that stood about 100 feet from the stage and podium at the front of the room.
"Okay, here's your seat. Here's a king-size Snickers. If you start to get sleepy, eat it,"
he said, giving me a candy bar the size of my forearm.
"All right, I gotta go do my shit."
The doctors filed into the rows, took their seats, and the conference started. My dad sat up on stage while some other guy with a giant forehead started talking. About 2 minutes in, I had already devoured the entire Snickers bar and was beginning to feel the effects of the 35 grams of sugar that were making their way into my bloodstream. Every minute of the lecture felt like an hour. I couldn't sit still and decided I needed to get on the ground so I could blow off some steam where nobody could see me. I crawled down onto the floor right as I heard the man speaking introduce my dad. I popped my head up, and as I did, I saw him, 100 feet away, staring at me intensely, as if he had been tracking me the entire time. I quickly ducked back down behind the chairs in front of me. As I crouched on the ground, I realized that I could fit in between the legs of the chairs, and that each row contained a few chairs that were empty. I thought it would be a really fun game, and no bother to anyone, if I crawled on my hands and knees from my row in the back to the front row, using the empty chairs to advance forward. I carefully began my journey, crawling laterally, underneath the unsuspecting rears of oncologist after oncologist, until I reached an open chair in the row in front, and then I'd move forward a row. It was like a real-life game of Frogger, and I was doing pretty well until I'd advanced 7 rows forward and realized there were no more open chairs in front of me. But when I turned around to go back, I saw that someone had filled in the one empty chair in the row behind me. I was stuck. The sound of my dad's voice over the speaker system sounded like the voice of God, if God were talking about molecular biology. I decided my only shot at getting back to my seat was to crawl over the feet of the 15 or so doctors who sat between me and the aisle, where I figured I could get really low to the ground and slither back to my chair without my dad spotting me. Unfortunately, the doctors didn't share my determination to hide my antics and did not play along as if nothing was happening. Instead, they stood up one by one as I tried to crawl past, whispering expressions of irritation to one another. And although I was on the ground and couldn't see anything, I heard my dad abruptly stop speaking. He knew something was up. I froze. When he started speaking again, I thought I was in the clear and forged ahead, until I accidentally smashed my knee into the loafer of a bearded guy sitting 2 seats from the aisle.
"Oh, God, this is ridiculous,"
he huffed through his whiskers. My dad stopped speaking again. I slowly crawled out past the last chair, then turned my head toward the stage, where he was staring right at me, along with everyone else. The lecture hall was completely silent as I stood up, pretending nothing at all had happened, and walked back to my seat, averting my eyes from the room full of disbelieving gazes. I sat back down in my chair. After a couple moments, my dad began speaking again. His face was bright red and looked like a dodgeball with a furious frown and angry eyebrows. Suddenly, his lecture on thyroid cancer had the same inflection as a coach tearing his football team a new one at halftime. My dad ended his talk quickly and rushed through answering a couple of questions. As the audience applauded, he hopped down off the stage, choosing not to use the stairs. He made a beeline toward me, ignoring all the doctors who stood up to chat or compliment his lecture. He picked me up by my belt from the back of my pants like he was holding a six-pack of beer, pushed through the doors to the lobby, and then outside into the light. He carried me like that all the way to the car, opened the door, and tossed me in the front seat. He got in the driver's seat, where he took a few deep breaths, the veins in his neck bulging with anger. Then he turned to me and through clenched teeth yelled,
"Fucking hell! All I asked, goddammit, was that you sit still for a couple hours while I lectured on thyroid cancer!"
He peeled out of the parking lot and drove us home in complete silence.
When we arrived at our house, he opened the front door. I was standing next to him on the doormat when he turned to me and calmly said,
"Listen, that was not a place where a kid should have been, I get that. But I'm going to go inside this house, and you are not. You're going to play outside of this house, because right now, my fucking head is going to explode."
Then he closed the door, and I stood outside, not sure what to do. From inside the house, I heard an echoing scream.
Fuck!
About a half an hour later, he poked his head out of the back door. I was sitting on the grass in our backyard.
"You can come on in if you want," he said. "Also, wash your hands before you touch stuff. That conference hall floor smelled like dog shit, and you were crawling around like a little monkey on it."
On finding out I didn't make the Little League All-Star team.
"This is bullshit! All the coaches just put their kids on the team! That shitbag son isn't worthy of carrying your jockstrap! You don't wear a jockstrap? What the hell is wrong with you, son?"
On dropping me off at school.
"Your friend's parents drive like assholes. Tell them it's an elementary school parking lot, not downtown fucking Manhattan."
On getting a dog.
"Who's gonna take care of it? You? Son, you came in the house yesterday with shit on your hands. Human shit. I don't know how that happened, but if someone has shit on their hands, it's an indicator that maybe the whole responsibility thing isn't for them."
On showering with regularity.
"You're 10 years old now. You have to take a shower every day." "I don't give a shit if you hate it. People hate smelly fuckers. I will not have a smelly fucker for a son."
On Legos.
"Listen, I don't want to stifle your creativity, but that thing you built there, it looks like a pile of shit."
On Bring Your Dad to School Day.
"Who are all these fucking parents who can take a day off? If I'm taking a day off, I ain't gonna spend it sitting in some tiny desk with a bunch of 11-year-olds.
On my 6th grade parent-teacher conference.
"I don't think that teacher likes you, so I don't like her. You ding off more shit than a pinball, but goddammit, you're a good kid. She can go fuck herself."
On my first school dance.
"Are you wearing perfume? Son, there ain't any cologne in this house, only your mother's perfume. I know that scent, and let me tell you, it's disturbing to smell your wife on your 13-year-old son."
On being afraid to use the elementary school bathrooms to defecate.
"Son, you're complaining to the wrong man. I can shit anywhere at any time. It's one of my finer qualities. Some might say my finest."
On my last place finish in the 50-yard dash during Little League tryouts.
"It kind of looked like you were being attacked by a bunch of bees or something. Then when I saw the fat kid with the watch who was timing you start laughing, well, I'll just say it's never a good sign when a fat kid laughs at you."
Do not be a goddamned liar.
"You have shamed the entire scientific community. Fucking Einstein. Everybody."
I've never been very good at math or science. I enjoyed the stories embedded in history and literature, but lost interest when it came to periodic functions and the table of elements. So in 6th grade, when each member of my class was responsible for creating an experiment to show at the school's science fair in late April, I felt about as excited as I'd feel today if I were told I had to attend a live reenactment of the entire first season of Grey's Anatomy. My dad, on the other hand, was thrilled. He had spent the past 25 years performing medical and scientific research.
"Now you can get a glimpse into what my life is like every goddamn day,"
he told me the night I received my assignment.
I'm going to be on your ass every step of the way. You will have the greatest science experiment that school has ever seen, or you will fucking die trying.
Will you do it with me?
I pleaded.
What? No, I already do it all goddamn day on my own. That's what I just told you.
He took a seat on our living room couch and motioned for me to take a seat next to him.
Now, experiments start with a question. What do you want to know?
I thought about it for a few seconds.
I think the dog is cool,
I said, motioning toward Brownie, our 5-year-old chocolate lab mix.
What? What the hell does that mean? That's not a fucking question.
What if I said, do people think the dog is cool?
Jesus fucking Christ,
he said, rubbing his temples.
Think of a question like, do larger objects fall faster than smaller ones? Something like that.
Okay, well, can the question be something about the dog?
It can be about whatever the fuck you want. Okay, you're stuck on shit with the dog, so how about this? Can dogs recognize shapes? How does that sound?
It sounded good. I loved Brownie, so I was glad he could be part of my experiment. My dad helped me outline exactly how the experiment would work. Basically, every day I would hold up in front of the dog 3 pieces of paper, each of which had a drawing of either a triangle, circle, or square. I would give him a treat every time I held up a circle, tell him to sit every time I held up a square, and do absolutely nothing every time I held up the triangle. After 15 days of training, I'd perform 2 days of trials when I'd hold up the drawings of the shapes without giving any of the corresponding rewards. The goal was to see whether or not he'd respond to the shapes in anticipation of the actions that had followed during the lead-up to the trials. I was supposed to record my findings in a journal throughout the entire 17 days. When I did my research the first day, it was really boring. The dog didn't understand what was going on. He just stared at me while I held up the pieces of paper and occasionally licked himself. He mostly just wanted to play, so I started running around the backyard, having him chase me until I got tired. My dad worked late every night, so he didn't know I wasn't following through with my experiment. He'd check in from time to time, and I'd tell him my research was going fine. I just assumed I had plenty of time. As long as I started 17 days before we had to turn in our findings at school, I'd be fine. But then I forgot about the experiment altogether. One afternoon, the teacher reminded us our experiments were due in 3 days, and my stomach dropped. My mom picked me up from school that day, and when we got home, I ran into my bedroom and shut the door. I took out my journal and began making up fake results from my non-existent tests, complete with fake corresponding dates. I figured that a sly way of hiding my laziness was to report that the dog had slowly started to recognize the shapes toward the end of the experiment. Then, when I did the trials without the rewards, he'd reacted in such a way that I knew he recognized the shapes. I remembered hearing a story about Pavlov's dogs. Pavlov sounded like a madcap scientist, and this experiment sounded like one he might even have performed himself. This was enough reasoning for me. My dad happened to get home early that day, and I heard him barrel through the door right as I finished writing up the last of my findings. I threw my pen across the room to get rid of any evidence of my fraud. Almost as if he knew what I was up to, my dad immediately came into my room.
How goes the science life?
He asked on cue. Before I could answer, he saw my journal and picked it up.
All the data's in there, Dad.
He was no longer paying attention to me, just perusing the data. After turning the pages and digesting my results for a minute, he set my journal down on my desk and looked at me.
So, the dog recognizes shapes, huh?
Yeah, it's weird,
I said, trying to sound ambiguous.
Yeah, that is weird, he said. You obviously don't mind, then, if I run a little test on the dog, just so I can see for myself,
he added. At that moment, I went a bit numb. All I could think was that maybe somehow, some way, the dog would know the shapes and react how I had written down that he reacted. My dad grabbed the crumpled pictures of the shapes from the floor of my room and walked outside.
Sometimes the dog doesn't do it, though. It depends on how he's feeling and stuff, I said, trying to cover myself for any possible outcome.
My dad wasn't listening. He called the dog's name, and Brownie ran over toward us. My dad proceeded to hold the first shape, a triangle, in front of Brownie's slobbering face. According to my data, Brownie was supposed to do nothing when he saw the triangle, which he did. Unfortunately, that was also his reaction to the circle and the square, which he was supposed to react to by sniffing my hand in anticipation of a treat and sitting down, respectively. Brownie ran off, and my dad turned to me. He looked me in the eye with an eerie sense of calm.
"I'm gonna give you a chance right now to tell me anything you want to tell me," he said.
I started crying immediately and, between heaving sobs and snorts, confessed that I had forgotten to do the experiment and fake the data. My dad grabbed my notebook, tore it in half, and attempted to hurl it over the fence, but the loose pages fluttered about like a disappointing confetti celebration. He started kicking them around and then, still not satisfied, grabbed one of the dog's toys and hurled it across the yard like a shot putter going for the gold. When Brownie retrieved the toy and pranced up for round two of what he thought was their game of fetch, my dad exploded.
"All bullshit! You wrote all bullshit!"
he screamed.
"I thought you said you'd give me a chance to tell you!"
I yelled back.
"Yeah, you told me, and then it was all bullshit, goddammit!"
My mom hurried out to see what was happening. She calmed my dad down and led him up to their bedroom so they could talk. After about 10 minutes, he returned to the backyard, still simmering.
"You have shamed the entire scientific community. Fucking Einstein, everybody!"
I told him I knew that, and I was sorry.
"This is what I do for a living, goddammit, and I take it very, very fucking seriously."
"I know you do."
"No, you don't know shit, so here's what's gonna happen."
He proceeded to tell me that I had to go to my teacher and confess that I didn't do my experiment and fake the data instead, and ask her if I could deliver an apology for cheating to my classmates.
"And if she says you don't need to do that, tell her tough shit, you're doing it anyway. And I want to see the statement you're going to read before you read it. I got final say."
The next day before science class, I explained to my teacher what had happened, and when the bell rang, she turned to my sixth grade class and told them I had something to say. I got up and read my prepared statement, which opened with something like this.
"To my classmates and to the science community, I have committed an act of fraud. I falsified my data, and in doing so, have taken a process that is important to the development of the human race and disgraced it."
After that, it went on for a few more lines, but no one, including myself, had any idea what in the hell I was talking about. In between sentences, I glanced out at 36th graders staring blankly at me. After I was done reading my statement, I sat down. The teacher thanked me, said a few words about cheating, and then we moved on. When I got home that night, my dad asked me how it went. I told him I had read the apology and that the teacher had thanked me.
"I'm sorry I had to be so hard on you, but I don't want people thinking you're a lying sack of shit. You ain't. You're a quality human being. Now go to your room. You're grounded."
On respecting privacy.
"Get the fuck out of here. I'm doing stuff."
On showing fear.
"When it's asshole tightening time, that's when you see what people are made of. Or at least what their asshole is made of."
On hypothetical questions.
"No, there's no scenario where I'd eat a human being, so you can stop making them up and asking me, understood? Jesus, is this how you spend your day, just coming up with this shit?"
On friendliness.
"Listen, I know you hate playing with that chubby kid because his mom's a loudmouth, but it's not that kid's fault, his mom's a bitch. Try to be nice to him."
On fair play.
"Cheating's not easy. You probably think it is, but it ain't. I bet you'd suck more at cheating than whatever it was you were trying to do legitimately."
On leaving my toys around the house.
"God damn it, I just sat on your goddamn truck guy. Optimus Prime? I don't give a shit what it's called. Keep it away from where I like to put my ass."
On child safety.
"Don't touch that knife. You never need to be holding a knife." "I don't give a shit. Learn how to butter stuff with a spoon."
On slumber parties.
"There's chips in the cabinet and ice cream in the freezer. Stay away from knives and fire. Okay, I've done my part. I'm going to bed."
On sharing.
"I'm sorry, but if your brother doesn't want you to play with his shit, then you can't play with it. It's his shit. If he wants to be an asshole and not share, then that's his right. You always have the right to be an asshole. You just shouldn't use that right very often."
It's important to know the value of a dollar.
Let's just shut the fuck up and eat.
Both of my parents grew up poor. My mom in an underprivileged Italian community on the outskirts of Los Angeles. Her mother and father both passed away before she turned 15, at which point she and her five siblings were split up between a few different relatives. And my dad on a farm in Kentucky, where he and his family worked as sharecroppers until he was 14 and his dad bought the farm.
When I had an earache, my mom would piss in my ear to kill the pain,
my dad once told me in an effort to illustrate the depths of his family's poverty.
That just seems weird, Dad. Not something poor people do.
Yeah, maybe that was a bad example,
he said after thinking about it for a moment. Regardless, my parents never missed an opportunity to remind me and my brothers that we had it good.
You prance around on your fucking skateboards and bikes like you're the goddamn Queen of England,
he used to tell us when we spent our weekends goofing off with friends and neglecting our chores. Sometimes my parents worried that my brothers and I had it too easy, that we'd grow up not understanding the value of a dollar or how it feels to struggle. Even before my mom attended law school and began working in poverty law, she spent a lot of her free time volunteering in the poor communities of San Diego. She worked with parents on welfare and with homeless families, organizing after-school programs, or helping them become self-sufficient to get off welfare. Anytime I complained about anything, she'd invoke those families.
Why aren't you eating your pasta?
She asked me one night over dinner when I was 10 years old.
It's got peas in it,
I replied.
So pick out the peas. Well, you know, I don't like peas, but you put peas in it anyway. Why do you do that?
I whined.
Excuse me? You're treading on thin fucking ice, buddy,
my dad barked, looking up from his plate.
That's your mother. You and she are not equals. Here's her,
he said, putting his hand high above his head.
And here's you,
he added, putting his other hand well below the table.
If she wants to serve only peas for the rest of fucking eternity, you will sit there every goddamn day and eat them and say thank you and ask for more.
Why would I ask for more if I hate them?
I said. My dad told me to leave the table and go to my room. Or at least that's what I think he said, because he was screaming with a mouthful of peas. About a week later, my mom came home from her law school library a little later than usual to find my brother Evan and me sitting on the couch watching TV a few feet from our dad, who was leaning back in his recliner, half asleep. She turned off the TV, rousing my dad, and told the three of us that she had an announcement.
We're going to eat what impoverished families eat, she proclaimed.
What does impoverished mean?
I whispered to Evan.
It means poor people or something,
he said, worry lines spreading over his face like a spider web. Our mom went on to explain that she had visited the grocery store where some of the poor families she knew through her volunteering shopped with their food stamps. She described the food, how only some of it was expired, though all of it looked disgusting, and then capped off her anecdote with,
"We're going to eat for a week only the food I purchase from that store, with the same budget as they do."
Dad,
I said, turning to him in desperation.
Dad thinks this is a great idea,
my mom replied before he could answer. A couple days later, our fridge and cupboards were stocked with the strangest looking foods I'd ever seen. I remember thinking to myself, poor people eat a lot of stuff in cans. Many of the cans' labels listed some kind of meat, and underneath the name of the meat, in water. Ham in water, chicken in water, cubed beef in water. The bread came in a white plastic bag on which there were only four words, white bread, fresh baked.
How is this fresh baked?
I asked Evan, holding a limp, floury slice in my hand.
I don't know. I guess at one point someone baked it, and then it was fresh.
At lunchtime, on the first day of our new food regime, I opened up the brown paper bag my mom had packed for me. The first item I pulled out was a foul combination of foodstuffs posing as a turkey sandwich. I held it up in front of me. The bread looked like two pieces of soggy sandpaper, and the turkey looked like it was made out of whatever Larry King is made out of, some kind of pasty white, stringy flesh.
That looks fucking nasty,
my friend Aaron said, staring at my sandwich like it was a mangled creature that had washed ashore after a tsunami. That afternoon, I came home and marched right into Evan's room. I asked him if his lunch bag was filled with the same inedible stuff as mine. It was. We each had thrown out our sandwich and the strange carrot-like vegetables that came with it, and eaten only the block of white American cheese that completed this so-called meal. I wanted to revolt, but Evan has never been the revolutionary type, and I wasn't prepared to stage a unilateral rebellion. The only hope I had was that my dad was feeling similarly disgusted and would put an end to this madness. A few hours later, while we boys were hanging out in the living room before dinner, my mom presented us with that evening's menu. "Turkey soup," she announced, wearing an apron and holding a large spoon, as strange smells emanated from the kitchen behind her. I looked at my dad, who kept his eyes on the evening news, unfazed. I was nervous about my physical ability to consume the meal my mom was about to serve, and as I usually do when I'm nervous, I voiced a positive thought in an effort to will the best possible outcome.
"I like turkey, right?"
I said. My dad continued to stare at the television.
"Are you asking me, or are you telling me?"
he said without so much as glancing my way.
"I'm telling you, I like turkey."
"Okay,"
he said, pausing for a moment before adding,
"What the fuck does that mean for me?"
I could tell he was in a bad mood, so I ended the conversation. Voicing my affinity for turkey had helped, and I felt more confident about being able to eat the soup. A few minutes later, we sat down to dinner, and my mom filled all our bowls with a brown, chunky liquid that resembled what I imagine a grizzly bear's diarrhea looks like. There were white chunks in it, as well as red chunks, and it was the consistency of a watery bowl of oatmeal. All of us looked at one another, even my mom. I stuck my spoon in the bowl and was careful to maneuver around the chunks and ladle up only liquid. I brought it to my lips slowly and purposefully, as if I were a spy ingesting a suicide pellet. Then I took a sip and spit it out.
"Jesus H. Christ, we're trying to have a meal here, goddammit!"
my dad shouted, dropping his spoon on the table.
"I can't eat this, I tried!"
I said as Evan laughed.
"You didn't try,"
my mom replied.
"I did, I can't eat it, it's too gross!" "This is how poor kids eat. This is the point of us eating like this, to understand what people less fortunate than us go through,"
my mom responded.
"I understand! I just want to eat something else now!"
I said as my eyes welled with tears.
"Everybody just be quiet. Let's just shut the fuck up and eat,"
my dad said. Then he put a spoonful of soup in his mouth.
"Jesus Christ, this is god-awful! I can't eat this!"
he said after swallowing it.
"See?"
I exclaimed.
"No, you two are eating this,"
he said, looking at me and Evan.
"I'm not."
"What?"
I shouted. I got up, stormed out of the dining room, ran into my room and slammed the door. I assumed that within a few seconds, my mom would open the door, say something that would make me feel better, and invite me back to the table for a proper dinner, like spaghetti with meatballs or chicken and potatoes. In the meantime, maybe she'd even drive to Jack in the Box and buy me a spicy, crispy chicken sandwich, my favorite, to make up for this unjust and traumatic culinary experiment. 10 minutes went by, and no one knocked on my door. I made a pact with myself not to leave my room until someone came for me. Another 10 minutes went by, then an hour, then 3 hours, and suddenly it was 10 o'clock, my bedtime. I turned the light out and crawled into bed, fuming and hungry. Then suddenly my door opened.
"Hey, Mom,"
I said, trying to sound angry and assuming it was her tucking me in as she did every night.
"Nah, it's me,"
my dad said, his large, shadowy figure approaching me, lit only by the light from the hallway behind him.
"Oh, hi,"
I replied coldly. He sat down on the bed and laid his hand on my shoulder.
"You're a pain in the ass, but I love you,"
he said, then laughed to himself. I didn't respond.
"I know you're pissed off. I even understand why you're pissed off."
"No, you don't,"
I said confidently.
"Oh, please, you're 10. I think I understand a goddamn 10-year-old.
Our conversation was not making me less upset, and he could tell. The tone of his voice softened.
"I know you think if you're eating that shit, I should have to eat it. And then I said I wasn't going to, and you had to, and now you're pissed off, yeah?"
"Yeah."
"I've been poor. So has your mom. There are a lot of things in my life that I try really hard to make sure you never have to experience."
"So why can't this be one of them?"
I asked.
"Son, you're spending a week eating shitty food. Your mom spent her whole childhood hungry. When you get up and throw a fit like you did tonight, it makes her feel like shit. It's like you're saying you don't care what she went through. That makes sense?"
I told him that it did, and he told me why my behavior had also upset him.
Food was a huge part of my life growing up. It's how we made our living, not just what we ate. So when you throw a fucking tantrum about it, it gets to me, he said.
But why do you not have to eat it? Mom's eating it, and she already knows what it's like. Why don't you have to eat it?
I persisted. He sat quiet for a second, then took his hand off my shoulder.
Well, two reasons. The first one is that I know the value of a dollar because I work every goddamn day to make them, something you've never done.
But Mom works too,
I interrupted.
Well, that brings me to my second reason. Your mom's a lot fucking nicer than I am.
Then he kissed me on my forehead and left the room. On videotaping Christmas morning.
Okay, smile when you open your present. No, smile and look at the camera, dum-dum.
On going camping with the family.
No, I'm gonna stay home. You can take a family vacation, and I'll take a vacation from the family. Trust me, it'll make both our time more enjoyable.
On receiving straight A's on my report card.
Hot damn, you're a smart kid! I don't care what people say about you. I'm kidding, nobody says you're not smart. They say other stuff, but not that.
On getting stung by a bee.
Okay, okay, calm down. Does your throat feel like it's closing up? Do you have to take a crap? No, that don't have anything to do with bee stings. It's just you're pacing back and forth. I thought maybe you had to go.
On how to tell when food's gone bad.
How the fuck should I know if it's still good? Eat it. You get sick, it wasn't good. You people, you think I got microscopic fucking eyes.
On dealing with bullies.
You're gonna run into jerk-offs, but remember, it's not the size of the asshole you worry about. It's how much shit comes out of it.
On silence.
I just want silence. Jesus, it doesn't mean I don't like you. It just means right now, I like silence more.
Not everyone's balls should be busted.
Shit, I forgot to pick you up, didn't I? Sorry about that. Anyway, I'm not coaching that fucking team anymore.
When I was 10 years old, my father, against his better judgment, volunteered to coach my Little League team. 6 months later, in the spring of 1991, Sam Halpern's coaching career came to an abrupt and angry end. When my dad moved to Point Loma, our seaside San Diego suburb, in 1972, it was mostly a military community. He had served in the Navy, and the familiar atmosphere and like-minded residents made him feel welcome. Over the years, Point Loma's proximity to the beach made it a desirable neighborhood to the wealthy, and huge houses sprouted up all around our modest three-bedroom home. My dad was not pleased.
I refuse to become a fucking yuppie by proxy,
he announced after a young couple moved in next door, replacing one of the last of the old military officers who had once lived on our street. Consequently, when I was growing up, my local Little League team, Tom Hamm's Lighthouse, was filled with the children of these people my dad disliked, and for the most part, they were spoiled, disrespectful kids. I knew almost right away it probably wasn't the best idea that my dad coached this team, but he loved baseball, and he loved me, and I think in his mind he figured that was enough. My dad's only rule as a coach was that all the kids play the same amount of innings per game, no matter their skill level.
It's Little League. You're all terrible for the most part, and that's okay. The only way you're going to stink less is by playing,
he told us at our first team meeting. So every game, my teammates and I rotated on and off the field, each of us playing 4 of the 6 innings. Sometimes the rotations wouldn't work out perfectly, and if someone had to sit out 3 of the innings instead of 2, that someone would be me.
You're actually good, and you know it. These other kids, it's fucking waterworks when I take them out of the game,
my dad said to console me.
So if I cried, I could play? That's not fair.
No, if you cried, I'd still bench you, and then I'd bench you more for crying about not playing an inning in a goddamn Little League game. You're my son, and life's a bitch.
During his first couple months as head coach, my dad did not exactly become a fan favorite among my teammates and their parents, who found his even playing time rule incorrigible. At one point during a game, one of the kid's parents started mouthing off at him from the stands, furious that his kid wasn't playing more.
We're losing because of you! Why would you bench the best player? It's moronic!
my snot-nosed teammate's father yelled.
Best player? I don't know what fucking game he's watching,
my dad mumbled to himself. The parent kept at it, clearly oblivious to my dad's growing anger and frustration. When the inning was finally over, Coach Halpern burst out of the dugout and stormed into the stands.
Everyone plays the same amount of innings. That's my rule. This ain't the goddamn World Series. It's Little League. Our right fielder picks his butt all game, and he gets that rule. Why don't you?
My dad's flare-up quieted the parents for the time being, but behind the scenes, I would hear rumblings from my teammates. At fielding practice a week or so later, a kid named Marcus tapped me on the shoulder. I turned around and he said,
My dad says your dad is an asshole.
I wasn't sure how to respond, so I just stood there for a few moments. Finally, I responded,
No, he's not. Your dad's wrong.
Then a baseball hit me on my shin, and I turned and realized it had been my turn in the ground ball line, and my dad had just hit one at me because I wasn't paying attention.
Pay attention, son! Don't stand there with your thumb up your ass!
My dad was not helping my case for him. Each practice, the parents and the spoiled kids would get to him a little more. He wanted this experience to just be about teaching baseball, but it wasn't. It was more of an unwelcome exercise in tolerance and self-restraint. Finally, the friction came to a head during a practice in May. The temperature was hot that day, and the kids decided they didn't feel like doing my dad's conditioning drills, which he had learned during his time in the Navy. After a series of foul-pole-to-foul-pole sprints, one of them staged a revolt and refused to follow his orders.
This is dumb! Baseball isn't about running! Any real coach would know that!
My teammate shouted, standing defiantly in front of my dad. The instant the sound of that kid's insubordinate voice hit our fearless leader's ears, my dad had the same reaction Bruce Willis has at the end of The Sixth Sense when he realizes he's been dead the whole time. Complete shock and confusion, followed by deep breaths in an attempt to calm himself. My dad's efforts to remain cool were futile. The argument spiraled out of control, ending with him screaming,
Coach your own goddamn team then, and kiss my ass!
To a group of 14 kids and one terrified assistant coach named Randy, who was only coaching the team because his wife had left him and he wanted something to take his mind off of his misery. Randy wasn't the most emotionally stable human being at the moment.
It's all yours, Randy! Have a blast!
My dad stormed off to his car and took off. Unfortunately, in his anger, he had forgotten that he was my ride. We were 3 miles away from home, and at that moment, I wasn't about to ask anyone else's parents for a ride. The kids were all staring at me, and Randy looked like he was about to start crying, so I decided I'd just walk home. An hour later, when I was about 2 blocks away from my house, my dad drove up alongside me and rolled down his window.
Shit, I forgot to pick you up, didn't I?
I nodded yes.
Sorry about that. Also, I'm not coaching that fucking team anymore.
After he removed himself from the head coach position, my dad still came to all of my games and followed the team closely. He and I would have our own practices on days when the team didn't practice.
Randy doesn't know shit about the game. He throws a baseball like he's a woman playing darts.
So 2 days a week, we'd practice pitching, just him and me. Then one day, as we were driving to the field for one of our practices, he took a different route.
Where are we going? The field's the other way, I said.
We're picking up Roger. He's going to play with us, he said.
Roger was the weirdest kid on the team by far. He smelled horrible, like rotten fruit mixed with Old Spice. He was actually a pretty good pitcher, but he'd have mental breakdowns in the middle of innings and completely implode.
Why are we picking up Roger?
I asked.
I'm teaching you pitching. He's the other pitcher on the team. I figured I'd teach both of you at the same time, he said.
We stopped in front of an apartment where Roger was waiting, and for the next couple weeks, Roger came and practiced with us. Afterward, my dad would buy us both ice cream. I told no one because I already wasn't the most popular kid on the team, and the last thing I needed was to be associated with Roger. At our second-to-last game of the season, my team played one of our better opponents. I had pitched the first 3 innings and kept the game close. Then Roger came in and pitched the 4th and 5th and shut them down as we took the lead in the bottom of the 5th. In the 6th, as Roger walked out to the mound, one of the parents from the other team got up from his seat in the bleachers and stood behind the fence that was 10 feet behind home plate. His name was Steve, and he was a burly guy with a large beer belly. he looked like someone Popeye would fight while on shore leave. Every time Roger started to throw, Steve would try to rattle him.
He can't throw strikes! Just take the pitches! He's going to walk all of you!
Steve yelled to his son and his teammates. Steve shouted undercutting comments like that every single pitch to psych Roger out, and Roger kept throwing balls, each one worse than the last. Eventually, he was crying on the mound, throwing balls that were 6 or more feet out of the strike zone. Randy walked out to the mound and took Roger out, and when Roger sat down on the bench next to me in the dugout, he was sobbing. Randy put his kid in, and Randy's son, also named Randy, threw just like his dad and gave up about 6 runs. We lost handily. After the game, my dad approached me and said,
"Wait here with Roger. We're giving him a ride home, but I need to take care of something first."
He walked over to the parking lot where Steve was helping his son pack up his stuff. I waited about 30 seconds, then followed, even though he told me to stay, mostly because I didn't want to hang out with Randy and Randy. They both always hugged everyone goodbye instead of waving or giving high fives, and it creeped me out. As I approached them, I saw my dad and Steve talking heatedly.
"It's part of the game, Sam," Steve said.
"Bullshit,"
my dad replied.
"Watch yourself, Sam."
"The kid's dad is a drunk. His family's a goddamn mess, and you know that. And you're sitting out there screaming at him, trying to rattle him like this is the goddamn major league so your kid can win a little league game? You're a grown man, goddammit. What in the hell is wrong with you?"
At that point, Steve mumbled a few more things, then got into his truck with his son, Kevin, and drove off. My dad took me and Roger for ice cream before dropping Roger off. We didn't say much on the ride home. I wasn't exactly sure what had gone on, but I knew that my dad was angry at Steve, and I figured maybe I could make him feel better somehow.
"I don't like Steve either, Dad. He's fat, and so is Kevin, and they think they're good at stuff, but they're only good because they're fat and bigger than everyone else," I huffed.
My dad was silent as he parked the car in our driveway. Then he turned to me.
"Son, I didn't understand one goddamn thing you just said. Take your cleats off before you get inside the house. I think you stepped in dog shit."
On my 8th grade graduation ceremony.
"They're celebrating you graduating from 8th grade? We just went to your 6th grade graduation 2 goddamn years ago. Jesus Christ, why don't they just throw a fucking party every time you properly wipe your ass?"
On puberty.
"How's puberty treating you? How do I know you're going through it? Oh, I don't know, maybe it's the 300 dick hairs you suddenly leave all over the toilet seat that clued me in?"
On asking to have the candy passed to me during Schindler's List.
"What do you want, the candy? They're throwing people in the fucking gas chamber, and you want a Skittles?"
On accidentally eating dog treats.
"Snossages? I've been eating dog treats? Why the fuck would you put them on the counter where the rest of the food is? Fuck it, they're delicious. I will not be shamed by this."
On trying out for the high school freshman football team.
"I ain't letting you try out. You're too skinny. No, I hate to break it to you, but you can't do whatever you want, and you most certainly are not a man."
On Bob Saget's demeanor while hosting America's Funniest Home Videos.
"Remember that face. That's the face of a man who hates himself."
On being intimidated.
"Nobody is that important. They eat, shit, and screw just like you. Well, maybe not just like you. You got those stomach problems."
On the medicinal effects of bacon.
"You worry too much. Eat some bacon." "What? No, I got no idea if it'll make you feel better. I just made too much bacon."